missed her. What happened to the car?
What do you think happened?
Looks like it was chewed up and spat out.
Perhaps it was a result of anxiety.
We made it. I think I actually counted incorrectly. I think I did this one a little bit earlier. I was going to do it every 4 weeks or so, but it's been a month, I guess, technically. All right. So let's go ahead and get started. I'll add these up. So if you're listening and you're not watching, I just have some slides up. To review, because I've spoken to some other folks that are going to give this a listen. In general, what is this? I'm working on a long form written piece that will examine many of the themes found in prior videos relating to the Syrian revolution, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, COVID, and now Israel-Palestine. To make this possible, I've stopped making long form videos for now until the written piece is completed, and that's going to take some time. Instead, we have these monthly live streams discussing topics involved or adjacent to those that I'm currently writing about, just so I have the bandwidth to do it. In past episodes, the first one was an introduction to Hamas. And in that, it was talking about October 7th and kind of what we need to do to get to that point, not only with Hamas and Palestine, but with Israel as well. The live stream covered the basics of Hamas as an organization, its history and development. We discussed the political and military arms, along with those of other groups, such as Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And this was generally just an overview that also touched on the importance of understanding October 7th from multiple perspectives to better understand what's happening today. Then the last episode was narratives and precedent for the Israeli-Hamas conflict. Continuing from the previous conversation, we delved into the intricate interplay between narrative, perception, and ideology with political discourse. We explored the nuanced distinctions between anti-imperialism, anti-authoritarianism, and leftist perspectives, recognizing that they may not always align seamlessly. In this context, we examined the role of organizations like the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, or PFLP, and their utilization of social media to shape perception and garner support. We then focused on the evolution of Hamas, how it balanced and adapted with political realities. Then we pivoted from the Fatah-Hamas conflict onto the 2014 Gaza War, dissecting its ramifications and the precedents that it established for contemporary events. By analyzing historical events through this lens, we gained a deeper understanding of current geopolitical dynamics and their implications. So we're still kind of building up. All of these things are equally important. It's not as if what we saw on October 7th was a watershed moment per se. In some ways, we'll get to it. That's how it is described. But in many other ways, as we saw in the last session, some of these things are there is precedence and context for them. It didn't come out of nowhere, and we'll talk more about that probably not the next time, but probably the session after the next one. But regarding the last episode, before we move on, it did result in an article where I recapped everything in written form. And this is going to be something that I continue to do moving forward. While I am trying to cap what it is I'm doing public facing right now, because of all this writing that I'm doing essentially in research, I will go ahead and summarize and recap in writing. And sometimes that's useful. It's more concise, it's shorter. And I know that people who read the newsletter might not always tune in for podcasts or live streams. And I know that people on the YouTube platform or folks that actually do make it to the live stream don't necessarily know about the newsletter. So they both exist, but they both work together. There's not too much on the newsletter that I'm putting out there that if you've been watching the channel that you haven't seen on the channel. Most of it's based on the videos, and it'll continue to be that way. All right, so that brings us to what we're going to be talking about tonight. And what we're going to be talking about tonight is largely things that were done by the Trump administration and the impact, the massive impact that those things had, especially in context to not so much the first episode, but more so the last episode in which we started talking about, okay, the 2014 Gaza war and how some of the things that we heard from or some of the things that we heard in that are things that we hear now. And getting away from not only looking at things that happened 100 years ago, but looking at things that happened, you know, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, because that's often overlooked, right? And I'm going to get into that a little bit at the end of this episode too, talking about some messaging from all perspectives, the right and the left, about what's going on and how some of it is problematic even within the left. And so we'll get there. But before we do, first we need to talk about Donald Trump, because really it was during this time period that the United States lost whatever credibility it had in terms of negotiating peace as a neutral arbitrator. And events really escalated. And we're going to look at it politically and historically, but also we're going to look at it thematically and even through the lens of religion. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Just touching upon these things. We're going to be done in an hour, hopefully. So none of this is going to be too in-depth, but let's go ahead and get started then. So where to begin? Well, we're going to start with the idea that Trump had and his administration to move the capital of, or to recognize, I should say, the capital of Israel as being Jerusalem, and to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem away from Tel Aviv and the ramifications that had. So Jerusalem is a city, of course, of religious and historical significance. For Jews, it's the location of the ancient Temple Mount and the Western Wall. For Christians, it's the site of Jesus Christ's crucifixion and resurrection. For Muslims, they hold the city in high regard as it being the home for the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, where it's believed that the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven. Modern Israel considers Jerusalem its capital, and its seat of government is located there. However, this status is not widely recognized, internationally speaking, at least. So why is that? In the 1967 Six-Day War, Israel captured East Jerusalem from Jordan and annexed that territory. This annexation was deemed illegal under international law and was not recognized by most countries, including the United States. Because of this, the U.S. kept its embassy in Tel Aviv. The city status remained one of the most contentious issues in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and was a central negotiating piece, even in the 90s. We went over the Oslo Accords and some things that happened after that. So, with this as the background, enters Donald Trump, right? So Trump declared that the United States would officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and that the U.S. embassy would be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This decision was very important for a few different reasons that are diametrically opposed to each other, relating to very different demographics. So first, this fulfilled a major campaign promise. During his 2016 presidential campaign, Trump repeatedly promised to make this move, appealing to his pro-Israel voter base, particularly evangelical Christians, who overwhelmingly supported the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Premillennialists view the creation of the State of Israel in 1948 as the fulfillment of a prophecy. This belief, not merely seen as a positive event, but a prophetic fulfillment or revealing, was popularized by Hal Lindsey's book in 1970, The Late Great Planet Earth. The book argued that contemporary world events, including Israel's establishment, were validating biblical prophecies. So for some Christians, this not only reinforced their faith, but also indicated that the end of the world was coming as foretold in the Bible. And this could take many forms, such as Armageddon, the rapture, etc. So there was a messianic view for these people in the actions of Israel's creation, but also in Trump's own actions. Second, the decision aligned with the Jerusalem Embassy Act of 1995. This act passed by Congress called for the relocation of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. However, it included a clause allowing presidents to waive the move on national security grounds, which had been done by every president since its inception, going all the way back to Bill Clinton through Barack Obama. So it's interesting because this act was passed, and it was passed overwhelmingly, 93 yeas to 5 nays, including many Democrats in favor. So, you know, there was a precedent for the move. However, as stated, there's also this escape clause. So there was some politicking going on, and every president, except for Trump, essentially skipped it. So, you know, it was an interesting time in history for this to occur. This was kind of in the midst of the 90s peace process and peace negotiations under the Clinton administration. And there are some domestic perspectives of this I think are interesting that I'm not necessarily going to go into, but regardless, the point is that there was a legal context for Trump doing this. Again, though, in the political kind of sphere, there was also this escape clause essentially that everybody had used. So by deciding to move the embassy, Trump broke with decades of U.S. foreign policy that sought to remain neutral on the status of Jerusalem, a strategy aimed at facilitating peace negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. His administration argued that this move acknowledged the reality that Jerusalem is Israel's capital and was intended to advance the peace process, in their own words, by removing such questions. It's a dubious claim at best. The announcement was made with a lot of publicity at the White House. Trump stated, in quote, "It is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel," emphasizing that this was a long overdue step. Trump directed the State Department to begin the process of relocating the embassy, which officially opened in Jerusalem on May 14th, 2018. And this opening coincided with Israel's 70th anniversary of independence. So this was quite a spectacle. The decision was met with mixed reactions, of course. Israeli leaders, including then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, hailed it as a historic moment and a just recognition of their capital. However, it sparked significant outrage and protests among Palestinians and across the Arab and Muslim world, leading to widespread demonstrations, of course. The U.S. announcement drew strong condemnation from many Muslim countries, and in response, the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation declared East Jerusalem, where there is a large population of Palestinians, the capital of Palestine. the OIC warned that the U.S. would be responsible for the consequences of this decision, essentially insinuating that there will be ramifications. Internationally, the decision was also met with a lot of criticism. Many U.S. allies, including European nations, expressed concerns that the move could destabilize the region, further undermine the already tattered peace process. The United Nations General Assembly held an emergency session where an overwhelming majority of countries voted to condemn the U.S. action. So some other responses. Of course, we talked about the broader Arab world and some of the macro responses, but getting down more granular, the Palestinian response. Well, the Trump administration's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and move the U.S. embassy there was obviously met with backlash from Palestinians. This move was perceived as a blow to Palestinian aspirations for East Jerusalem as the capital of a future Palestinian state. And in that regard, also was perceived as a blow to the reality or the possibility of a future Palestinian state. After the announcement, protests erupted throughout the West Bank and Gaza and across the broader Arab region. In the West Bank and Gaza, demonstrations quickly turned violent, with clashes between Palestinian protesters and Israeli security forces. These protests reflected the deep frustration and anger felt by Palestinians, who saw the decision as a dismissal of their historical and political claims to East Jerusalem. But if you had watched the past two episodes, really what we've done is gone from the 1980s until now and talked about the frustrations at each step of the way for Palestinians seeking a state, you know, even within the framework of a two-state solution. So the Palestinian Authority responded by cutting off communications with the Trump administration. Palestinian leaders declared that the United States could no longer be considered a neutral mediator in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas stated that the decision effectively disqualified the United States from its longstanding role as facilitating peace negotiations, accusing the Trump admin of a blatant pro-Israel bias, one that is pretty hard to deny. The diplomatic freeze significantly hindered any ongoing efforts for the U.S. brokered peace talks that were occurring. The move was seen as the U.S. unilaterally deciding the status of Jerusalem without considering Palestinian claims or the broader implications or ramifications for peace and stability in the region. And it, again, greatly delegitimized the role of the United States in the peace process. Forget being a leader in that process. The broader Middle East. The Trump admin's decision was also condemned across the U.S. and significantly including U.S. allies. So Jordan and Saudi Arabia, both of which have historically maintained close ties to the United States, were among the first to voice their strong opposition to this. Jordan, which oversees Muslim holy sites in Jerusalem, warned that the move could have dangerous repercussions for regional stability and the peace process, a theme that will continue to come up over and over again, concern over stability and any type of peace negotiations that might occur. King Abdullah II of Jordan emphasized that there is no alternative to a two-state solution with East Jerusalem as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Saudi Arabia expresses disapproval and warning of regional instability. The Saudi stance reflected broader concerns that the move could undermine the kingdom's efforts to present itself as a mediator in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and as a leader in the broader Arab world. The broader Middle East response was not limited to official statements and diplomatic maneuvers, as we discussed earlier. The decision sparked widespread protests in the region, ranging from Cairo to Tehran and from Beirut to Istanbul. These protests varied in intensity, but it had a unifying effect in a way, even among government officials who would normally be very opposed to each other, say Saudi Arabia and Iran. It was fairly unified in opposition of the U.S. decision. The move was almost universally panned and seen as provocation that would further destabilize an already volatile region. Critics argued that would embolden extremist groups and potentially lead to an upsurge in violence. So I kind of just said a lot, and I said it at a pretty good clip. Absorbing all of that, I think that that last piece is very important, along with some other things. Of course, the idea that the United States was acting unilaterally, the idea that the United States had lost whatever legitimacy that it did have in as a key broker in any kind of peace negotiation at that time. The idea that the move was done without soliciting any input from Palestinian leadership or really anybody aside from Netanyahu and maybe some Christian evangelicals that voted for Trump. But I think the part that should weigh on our minds is, you know, how this is really throwing the match into the powder keg, right? How everything that we had seen up to this point, from a negotiated peace process to a rejectionist victory in on both sides with Likud in Israel and Hamas in Gaza, all the way up to this point. Think about it in context to the 2014 Gaza war and then the coming October 7th attacks that occurred. Because this is when escalation really began to roll, not just between Israel and Palestine, but in a broader geopolitical sense, I believe. So speaking about broader geopolitical responses, the global response. The global reaction to the Trump administration's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and move the U.S. embassy was swift and overwhelmingly negative. The international community largely condemned the move, just as everybody else did. One of the most significant indicators of global opposition came from the United Nations. The UN General Assembly convened an emergency session shortly after the announcement. 128 countries voted in favor of a resolution calling on the United States to withdraw its recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Only 9 countries voted against the resolution, with 35 abstaining. So this vote underscored the widespread international consensus against the U.S. decision, and it highlighted the beginning of isolation of both Israel and the United States on a global stage regarding the Israel-Palestinian conflict. The resolution was non-binding, but it did carry significant or symbolic weight. It reaffirmed the international community's commitment to a two-state solution with Jerusalem as a shared capital for both Israel and a future Palestinian state. The vote also reflected broader concerns about the implications of unilaterally changing the status of Jerusalem without a negotiated agreement between Israelis and Palestinians. You know, along with this, we have to think of 2014, or maybe even later, when there was an official, you know, invasion of Russia into Ukraine. But just talking about unilateral actions by extremely powerful governments worldwide, and the supposed, you know, global order that is supposed to exist, and how large governments, powerful governments, are supposed to be the role modeling of this, and how all of this had was quickly going away. And the world was quickly changing. So the Imam of Egypt's Al-Azhar Mosque, one of Islam's most important institutions, said, in quote, "It incites feelings of anger among Muslims and it threatens world peace." This mosque is, again, among some of the most important in the Middle East, in the Muslim world. Hamas urged Palestinians to abandon peace efforts and launch a new uprising against Israel in response to Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as its capital. So yeah, moving towards events that would occur a few years later on October 7th, right? Hamas urging Palestinians to completely abandon the peace efforts, which they had kind of always done anyway, advocating instead for a Islamic nationalist revolutionary single state. And asking for essentially a new intifada, right? Various factions in the region, not just Hamas, called for a day of rage. and a wave of protests occurred, as described earlier, throughout the West Bank and Gaza. A jihadist Salafi group called, I'm going to butcher this, but Al-Tawhid Brigades launched rockets into Israel in response. A Hamas leader, in quotes, "We should call for and we should work on launching an intifada in the face of the Zionist enemy." Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, called for a third intifada and for Arab countries to lead the peace process entirely. Al-Qaeda and all of its official affiliates published a statement in support of Palestine, calling for Muslims to mobilize, for attacks to be carried out, and all possible support, whatever form it may take. The Taliban called Trump's plan a reckless step and an example of anti-Muslim bigotry. They claimed that it would, quote, "fan the flames of conflict in the entire world, especially in the Middle East." They also said that the move, quote, "has fully exposed its colonial face and declared enmity towards Islam, as well as support for the policy of occupation and colonialization of Muslim lands. If the Muslim world fails at giving a brotherly hand to one another and approaching their problems in union, recognizing anti-Islam plots and continuing squandering opportunities, then the moments are close when Muslim sanctums shall further be degraded and the very existence of Muslims shall face immense danger." So it just goes on and on. I have some loose notes here. In another announcement, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade referred to Trump as Satan and called out the Arab and Muslim ummahs to support an armed struggle to liberate all Palestinian land. It concluded the announcement by promising, in quotes, "We will die and live for Jerusalem. It is the heart of our faith and honor, and we will advance towards it with millions of martyrs." So I don't need to continue. There's more. But I think maybe we can take a breather here and kind of talk about what it is that we saw. So this is, we've gone a long way from negotiated peace talks with Oslo and then, the second intifada and then infighting between Fatah and Hamas. We've gone a long way from that to essentially every, far right Islamist group in the world coming together, and countries in the Middle East that are generally diametrically opposed to each other, like Saudi Arabia and Iran, also coming together, all to condemn Israel and the United States, all in one way or another, arguing for some type of protest, at the very least, or intifada, violence against the U.S. or Israel. You can see the ground with it, the swell forming for how we got to where we are today. And I think it's just very important because it's important because people can get nihilistic about this and feel hopeless. And regardless of what you think about the people involved, or regardless of what you think about the various versions of peace plans put forward, whatever you think about the intentions of the people involved, all of that aside, times were different. Not that long ago, right? And so it's important to understand how things have changed and why things have changed, and the moving of the capital to Jerusalem and the recognition of that, and moving of the U.S. embassy was really like a key moment. Not only if we're talking about in terms of negotiations and what is there to negotiate, but also just symbolically as well. And I'll get a little bit more into why the symbolism of this is important too. But there are some other things that the Trump administration did as well that we first need to get through. And they're all kind of connected to the moving of the Capitol, but they are different as well. And so they're going to play a direct role and be quoted, not maybe directly, but indirectly by Hamas officials, for instance, or by outlets like PFLP communications later. So it's good to understand how, again, we're getting to what happened in October and then how that event essentially got us to where we are now with the Israeli military. What do you want to call it? I mean, it's forced movement at best, ethnic cleansing, right, at worst, but where we're at now. Okay, so after or consecutive with the moving of the capital, we also have the U.S. recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. And this is another huge thing for many different reasons that's going to unite many different factions who normally wouldn't be united against the United States and Israel. So on March 25th in 2019, President Trump made a controversial move by signing a proclamation at the White House, officially recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Netanyahu and other dignitaries attended the ceremony. So some background on this. The Golan Heights was captured by Israel from Syria during the Six-Day War in 1967. Israel formally annexed the territory in 1981, a move unrecognized by the international community until President Trump's proclamation. This marks the first instance of a country other than Israel acknowledging its sovereignty over the Golan Heights and compounded the acceptance of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. So there's a lot of different angles to this. I have them kind of broken out, I guess, starting with diplomatic and security. So the recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights had immediate and wide-ranging effects on regional diplomacy and security. It enhanced U.S.-Israel relations. So we can start there. The decision was perceived as a strong show of support for Israel, solidifying the close ties between the Trump administration and the Israeli government, which was a Netanyahu regime still then. Prime Minister Netanyahu lauded the move. Regional tensions. The announcement sparked condemnation from Syria, which claims the Golan Heights as its territory. Other countries in the region and beyond also criticized the decision, arguing that it violated international law and United Nations and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. These resolutions called for Israel's withdrawal from territories occupied during the 1967 war. Impacts on the peace process. By recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, the U.S. departed from its traditional role as a neutral mediator in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, essentially validating statements from groups such as the Taliban. Palestinian perspectives. The decision was met with outrage, of course, by Palestinian leaders who saw it as another blow to their aspirations for statehood and self-determination. It further eroded trust in the U.S. as a fair broker and fueled skepticism about the prospects for any negotiated settlement. The Arab states' reaction. Arab states, many of which have historically supported the Palestinian cause, condemned the move, viewing it as a violation of international law and a threat to regional stability. Some Arab leaders warned that it could undermine broader peace efforts and fuel extremism in the region. And, you know, at this point, too, it sounds exacerbating, and I'm sure it was for Palestinians who are following this. And, you know, it's something else that is important among all this as well, even, you know, after we talked about a somewhat of a unity government occurring, or at least Hamas tolerating Fatah in Gaza, is this just essentially lending weight to a rejectionist view that Hamas, you know, owns, as well as some of the axis of resistance and other smaller groups that we talked about last time. But when you're looking at the people who you're negotiating with in a Likud, far-right, Netanyahu-led government, and then the major historical broker between the two in a far-right Trump government, you know, a two-state negotiated, or forget two states, any type of negotiation doesn't seem very realistic. And I do think that it started to impact perceptions of people who might have at that point not been fans of Hamas, for instance. But regardless, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, all criticized Trump's decision. And, you know, some of these countries, Kuwait criticizing the United States is really something. It even unified them, as I mentioned earlier, with Iran in condemnation, who called it a throwback to colonial land grabs. So again, with the international community, including European allies and key actors in the United Nations expressed concern about the unilateral nature of the decision. And I put that in context to Russia's invasion of Ukraine as well. And its potential to inflame tensions in an already volatile situation, of course. There were calls for a return to the negotiating table and a reaffirmation of the principles of international law, of international order of any type, as opposed to just these unilateral actions being done by the most powerful governments in the world. United Nations Security General Antonio Guterres said, and quote, it's clear that the status of Golan has not changed. The UN's policy on Golan is reflected in the relevant resolutions of the Security Council, and that policy has not changed. A UN Security Council resolution adopted unanimously by a 15-member body in 1981 declared that Israel's decision to, and this is in quotes, decision to impose its laws, jurisdiction, and administration in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights is null and void and without international legal effect. I want to stop here, though, because I've been talking a lot about Syria, and this is not to somehow justify the Assad regime or justify actions of the Syrian government over the past few decades. I'm not doing that. What I'm trying to do instead is show how these particular actions by the Trump administration just absolutely blew up the situation in a way that is different than those that we've seen in the past. So speaking of this in Syria, regional tensions, the Syrian response, of course, Syria vehemently rejected the US decision, vowing to reclaim the Golan Heights, quote, by any means necessary. The Syrian government viewed the move as a flagrant violation of its territorial integrity and sovereignty, further straining relations with Israel and its allies, or Israel and just regional governments. The following is a quote from an Al Jazeera article citing a Syrian foreign ministry source, quote, "The Syrian nation is more determined to liberate this precious piece of Syrian national land through all available means," quote, adding that Trump's statement was, in quotes, "irresponsible and show contempt for international law." The Syrian Negotiations Commission voiced its rejection of the decision and its national commitment to Syria's rights to retrieve all of its occupied territory. So again, I'm not sitting here because this is a very tricky topic in ways that some of you probably are aware of, but in ways that I'm not going to get into for this podcast. No one here is standing for Assad or the Syrian government, but instead just again showing if anything, aside from just inciting, right, the situation, making everything worse, also just taking negotiation pieces off of the table, right? Forgetting everything else, just unilaterally removing things that could be used in a future negotiation for a real life, not just rhetorical, but a real life Palestinian state to actually occur. So talking about countries that, you know, disagreed and actually formed in union with some surprising other countries, but that we're not necessarily here to prop up, Iran's involvement. So Iran is a key ally of Syria, of course, and a staunch opponent of Israel. It condemned the recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. The Iranian leadership warned of dire consequences and vowed to support Syria in its efforts to resist what it perceived as Israeli aggression and U.S. colonialism. And, you know, it makes the discussion just that much more complicated, doesn't it? When the actions of a U.S. administration essentially help validate propaganda from regional governments who themselves are no innocents, but for whom can now say, well, okay, we may do this, but you do that. And the everything just gets muddied, right? Everything just gets worse. Not that this didn't happen before, going all the way back 100 years, or going back to the 40s, or going back to the 60s, but talking about now, right? Just talking about actual modern events, things that directly led up to what we're seeing now. This is very important, and something that isn't, at the time it was talked about, but then it went away, and people haven't really talked about it much. As a matter of fact, you even see people of questionable, you know, what can we say, intentions, you know, trying to say that Trump would be a better candidate in this situation. That he would actually be a peace candidate because he's like this isolationist conservative or something, which is just blatantly false. All right. But going back to that Iranian involvement. So Hassan Rouhani said that the U.S. move is, quote, trampling on international regulations about Golan. Iranians too should resist and that way gain victory over the U.S. and Israel. So just lots of people, from government officials to religious figures to paramilitaries and Islamic groups, all basically saying resist, right? And what that means, depending on who it's coming from, is different, but it's fairly unified, and it should help inform us again on how we got from Oslo, whatever you thought about it, to now. So kind of summarizing these things, these are only two actions, you know, and last time we talked about, I don't know, like 7 or 8 different things, but these two things were just so impactful and had such, it escalated everything, it accelerated everything so quickly that I wanted to focus on them and really talk about their significance. These two actions essentially mobilized every group in the region against the U.S. and Israel, and is an important key to what we see in October 7th, because, of course, what happened in October 7th wasn't something that was just planned over a period of weeks or months. So on top of this, right, on top of this, there was the Peace to Prosperity, Trump administration's version of a peace plan. So its full name was Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve the lives of the Palestinian and Israeli people. It's still on the White House website if you want to check it out in the archives. I'll put all the links in the notes. I realize I didn't do that on the first episode. So some background on this, because it's again another problem. On January 28th, 2020, President Trump unveiled his administration's proposed Israeli-Palestinian peace plan, a move that sparked widespread debate and controversy yet again due to its perceived one-sidedness and lack of Palestinian involvement. So some analysis of the criticism. The first thing, the biggest thing, is the one-sided nature of it. Many analysts criticize the plan for favoring Israeli interests and imposing unrealistic conditions on Palestinian statehood. Critics argue that it effectively paved the way for Israeli annexation of the West Bank, diminishing the prospects for a viable Palestinian state. Trump's plan proposed a fragmented Palestinian state that ceded crucial portions of the West Bank to Israel. It aligned with Israel on crucial, very divisive matters like borders and Jewish settlements. Palestinians, of course, rejected this peace plan. Palestinian authorities immediately rejected the plan, citing its failure to address key issues such as the right of return for Palestinian refugees in their eyes and the borders of a future Palestinian state. They viewed the plan as basically it's a non-starter, and accused the Trump administration of bias in favor of Israel. And the Trump administration had to have known that this would be the reaction. So, you know, you can try to interpret what it is that they were trying to achieve from this, whether it was throwing red meat at their voting base, whether it was actually ideological and they just didn't care. you know, I don't know, but it would be naive to believe that anyone in the administration thought that any of this was going to somehow end in peace. So Israel's response: Netanyahu was facing impending corruption charges at this time and capitalized on the plan to divert attention away from his own personal issues. Following its unveiling, Netanyahu committed to annexing substantial areas of the West Bank. So by embracing the plan, Netanyahu aimed to solidify backing of his right-wing supporters and enhance his electoral chances to form the coalition that we see today. And we see the consequences of that coalition being in power today. Aside from this new ideological government in which he was really relying on in order to form a government in the parliament, it also, you know, put off those corruption charges and put them in the background a little bit to take some heat off of him personally. This didn't work, though, because November 21st, Netanyahu got hit with serious charges involving breach of trust, taking bribes, and fraud. This forced him to give up some of his ministerial roles, but he held on to the prime minister role. The trial began in May 2020, and on May 20th of 2024, a few days ago, the International Criminal Court's prosecutor's office said that it had requested an arrest warrant against him over possible war crimes in Gaza, of course, along with the Hamas leader Sinwar as well. I'm going to stop there because there's a lot going on, right? So just slowing it down and looking at the Israeli side of this. So yes, there was definitely opportunism involved with this, especially from Likud. And I'm not going to get into the concept of greater Israel in this session, but we will. So, but the idea of expanding Israel, right? So this was an opportunity that was definitely taken by Netanyahu. In taking that opportunity, talking about Trump throwing red meat to his base, this was Netanyahu throwing red meat to his base as well, in a very precarious time involving his electoral future. So it consolidated right-wing support in Israel too. So there's that piece. And it's very interesting to see the parallels between Trump and Netanyahu, even going to the corruption charges and what we see in trials that are ongoing today, right, for both men. But with Netanyahu specifically, this idea of being brought up on these various charges of bribery, et cetera, and breach of trust, how we've seen in many times, right, wagging the dog, right, creating a conflict to divert attention away, and also creating conflict, because in conflict generally, then that people come together, there's nationalism, support, patriotism, and there's oftentimes consolidation of support for leadership, including Netanyahu, who I'm sure, like some other ex-presidents, had considered the idea that as long as he is in leadership, maybe he'll be outside of the reach of the law. So there's just a lot happening in this one little section, going all the way up to events that occurred a few days ago, right? Just adding on to it. Okay, so outside of the political and event-based escalation. So, you know, this is interesting, and I guess I'm kind of getting close to the end here, but we still have quite a bit to say, because those are the three major things, and there are other things that happened, but I wanted to stop because I wanted to kind of to brief on those things and have another discussion that is adjacent to this one. So we have the moving of the capital to Jerusalem and the moving of the U.S. embassy there. We have recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, and we have this peace offering, right? This peace plan that is just clearly pro-Israel, and we see all the ramifications of that delegitimizing the United States, isolating the United States and Israel in the global community, but how it also acted as to accelerate calls for intifada. There's no other way to put it. It calls for uprising, which is in the propaganda, when we'll get to it, what or how Hamas described October 7th. So I'm not saying that, you know, because of this, October 7th happened. That's not true. But you can begin to see how the lines are forming, right? To how we got there and why we got there. Because I feel like still for many people, it's it seems as if it came out of nowhere, right? Or you know, how did this happen? And the way that many on the left react to that is, well, in settler colonial kind of, you know, rhetoric, or talking about, you know, the Nakba, also Israeli independence, you know, depending who you're asking, talking about stuff that happened in the 1900, Balfour Declaration, and there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. It is highly politicized, and there's a lot of propaganda involved with it, but it's also history, and I mean, that's okay. It just depends on how it's presented, but There's a lack of this kind of discussion, I think, in context to what we're seeing now. There are websites that have timelines out there, and those are helpful, but there's a lot of discussion that needs to be wrapped around these different, you know, points on the line. And that's kind of where I'm going with this. And we've done this before. We talked about the idea of reactionary or conservative anti-imperialism, for instance. And you know, there's a huge discussion with that that I kind of left off the table at that point, but that we'll get to in the future for sure. And that's the kind of discussion I'm going to have now, because I'll just get into it and then we'll see. So outside of the political and event-based escalation, there's more. Rabbi Mendel Kessen has a podcast called Torah Thinking. And I'm not Jewish, but I'm not necessarily versed on his work. However, from what I know, he's fairly conservative. We'll put it that way. And he discussed Trump's moving of Israel's capital to Jerusalem in some insightful and messianic ways. And when I say insightful, that doesn't mean that I agree. In fact, I don't agree. But I mean, it provides insight into a viewpoint that I wouldn't otherwise be aware of or I wouldn't hear. It's not in my algorithm, right? This guy's not in my algorithm. I'm not getting his point of view, but he represents a segment of the population. So most of those, or let me go back. I worked for a Jewish historical society almost a decade. And I had some minor work published with them. I'm not Jewish myself, but most of the people I worked with practiced Reform Judaism, essentially, or progressive forms of Judaism. So I do have a background. I'm not a Torah scholar, but I have some historical background in this. It's pretty crazy because I also worked at a Ukrainian society, historical society, at the same time, and. Yeah, that led to many long videos that some of you have watched. But in criticism of the move, this rabbi observed that, and I do find this interesting, and I maybe agree, I don't know enough, but I see how it tracks. He observed that this action gave a new cause to Arab resistance with parallels to the Crusades, because the Crusades were viewed as Christians attempting to take Jerusalem away from Muslim control, and that Trump's move could be interpreted as another act in this ongoing historical narrative as the West symbolizing Christianity and the Crusades, of course, Europe, the West in this Christian in endeavor to recapture the Holy Lands. And I think it's sometimes, especially the left in particular, removes religion from the equation and instead makes the total conversation, a critique about colonialism, whether it's Marxist or decolonial or otherwise. But I also think that groups in the region tailor their propaganda and messaging to different audiences and secularize content meant for mainstream or left-wing audiences in the West. So regardless, it's foolhardy to dismiss the role of religion when it comes to interpretation and narrative, at the very least, when we're talking about things occurring there. It's not all of it, and there are secular people that are involved with this. But at the same time, talking about religion in context of Israel and Palestine shouldn't be like some type of left-right divide. That doesn't make sense to me. It's a reality among other realities. The rabbi went on to say, he also framed these events that happened somewhat quickly in a messianic way. So he said that it also framed events in a messianic lens, claiming the succession of rapid events was something of a revelation, and that Trump was, in this way, and don't laugh, a messianic figure, even if he didn't realize it. And I'll give him credit for that. this doesn't mean, in his own words, that, you know, Trump was a prophet or something, although we see a lot of the very silly cartoons and things spread on, you know, Getter and all these other, you know, Gab alternative sites. But more seriously, from the rabbi's perspective, it's not that Trump was a prophet or a messiah. He's not even Jewish. But it's that he was creating a paradigm shift and overturning established norms, such as deferring on the Jerusalem question. And so in changing the paradigm, he was acting within a messianic framework without himself being a messiah, right? And this is appealing to both a segment of some conservative sects within Judaism, but also the evangelical Christian right that we talked about earlier before. So conversely, you know, the opposite might be true for some Muslim sects, instead viewing Trump, as mentioned prior, continuing a political war, yes, but also a cultural and spiritual war against them as well. And when this begins to become blatantly unilateral, it only serves to reinforce what might on its own be troubling rhetoric, I guess, if that makes sense. So, you know, I really thought about this. And that being said, I think it's important to say that many rabbis would completely dismiss all of this as nonsense. And I have spoken with rabbis in that mold. So it's not just me saying they're probably, I know for a fact that they exist. However, you know, insight is valuable in these discussions, which is why it's important to understand that which you may disagree with. In doing so, it might even provide insight or some self-critique. And this is another touchy subject. You know, religion is, in terms of what's happening in the Middle East, is a touchy thing in leftist or activist circles to talk about, acknowledge the reality of it, I suppose, in certain ways. Especially if we talk about, you know, extreme groups, whether they be members of the Likud parliamentary group that we have, whether they be Israeli settlers and the religiosity of what's happening there, or conversely with Islamic groups as well. It's kind of like a hands-off thing, and it's denying some realities. But talking more about self-critique. So this is a bit off topic. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it's also something I thought of when I was listening to the rabbi. At one point, he stops calling Palestinians Palestinians, and he simply calls them Arabs. And he clarifies this by claiming that Palestinians don't exist. They are not indigenous to Palestine. They are just Arabs. And they are Arabs that migrated to the region from Syria and surrounding areas during the British mandates. I'm going to say that again because I want you to remember this for later. This rabbi, this conservative, clearly conservative, U.S.-based, I believe, rabbi, at one point stops calling Palestinians Palestinians and simply calls them Arabs. He clarifies this by claiming that Palestinians aren't indigenous to Palestine, but instead were Arabs that migrated to the region from Syria and surrounding areas during the British mandate. They migrated there during the British mandate. They aren't indigenous. Palestinians don't really exist. They're just Arab people. Okay, remember that. He also went on to talk about the peace process as a charade as well, and essentially, you know, talked about it as political manipulation by a people, Arabs, who repeatedly lost militarily and are seeking alternative forms of victory politically or in hearts and minds. Of course, I don't agree with any of this, but it does provide insight into somehow people view the situation, which is clearly false and racist, right? And in talking about this, I mean, it's bunk, but you know, it doesn't really matter regardless of the validity of it. And this is kind of something else that I thought of when listening to him. I spoke to a progressive rabbi last November. We had a few meetings and we were thinking about doing something, and holidays happened and we just didn't put it together. But, you know, he made an argument that historical discussion is often, essentially, historical discussion has its pros and it has its cons. It has its strengths and it has its limitations. And it's often biased or inaccurate from every perspective, whether we're talking, whether it's Israel or representatives from Gaza or the West Bank or the US or whatever. But at the end of the day, those things aren't changing the current situation. And so by focusing on them, especially if they're politicized or out of context, it doesn't offer any immediate solutions if what it is that we're actually looking for is ceasefire and peace. And that's a question, you know, that we have to ask when we're talking about the Balfour Declaration and the Nakba, but not talking about things that happened under the Trump administration with the same amount of effort, right, or veracity. And, you know, one might say to counter that, I think, is that, well, this is the voice of someone who doesn't want to deal perhaps with a complicated topic that might challenge him or might in some ways, you know, contradict his worldview. After all, he's progressive, but he's still a rabbi. And maybe he doesn't want to talk about those things because they're ugly things, right? And that's probably the counter to that. But my honest feeling was that it was much more about practicality, with equal parts, I think, suspicion regarding motivations about, you know, why are you emphasizing on this so much when there are things that happened 3 or 5 years ago that have a much, you know, that are also very important. I'll put it like that, you know? So that's where like the suspicion comes in, but also the practicality of it. Again, there's a place for that. My undergrad is history. I've taught college level history classes and I get it, right? But if we're doing this in activist circles or if we're doing this in current events, you know, what are we extracting from that in order to achieve peace and ceasefire today? And I think it's a good question, you know, to ask. But it also made me think of some other less than helpful things, I'll say, that have been said by the left as well about the situation. And I say the left in general, what's the left, you know, but the further that I delve into these things, people use different ways to differentiate themselves. Anti-authoritarian, for instance, man, is something I saw a lot in Eastern Europe to differentiate leftist, progressive, socialist, anarchist from communism because of the historical issues of communism in Eastern Europe. And I don't know, you know, anti-authoritarian in the West can mean something different. In 2014, that could mean you're a national socialist, for instance. It really depends on where you're coming from. So I don't know what the correct label is, but for this I'm talking about the left, and that's where I'm coming from as far as I know. Along with those who are trying to sneak anti-Semitism into left spaces, which I will talk about, right? There have also been, along with that, just some inaccurate things said by people who are leftist. And I want to differentiate that because, kind of like talking about religion, this is something that, especially in activist circles, people do not want to hear. And if it's brought up, it's automatically chalked up to, oh, well, those are the LARPers, those are the Nazis that are just showing up and trying to get some publicity and, you know, what have you. And there's issues with that attitude, but I'll get into that. That's way in the future. That's more along the lines of what I'm writing about right now. But so it's not about infiltrators, right? It's about the left. And I think that that's something that is that needs to be differentiated. And it's constructive criticism. So, for instance, a few days ago, I saw a tweet, and, you know, take that for what it's worth. But paraphrasing, it essentially said, just send all the Zionists and back to Europe and Brooklyn, and then you'll have your peace, right? Send all the Zionists back to Brooklyn, and there you go, right? Job done. And you know, this is from a hammer and sickle socialist, you know, all Red Rose account. And it's troubling on a few points. Of course, beginning with exactly how that would happen. And I think we all kind of like understand the insinuations of what that is. But also it presents a narrative that many on the left echo, which, and this is going way off the rails, but it's okay. You know, it's because I'm going to do it anyway. But essentially that most Jews in Israel are white Europeans that aren't indigenous to the region, but were brought there during the British Mandate. And I want to repeat that because I told you to remember something that I said about 5 minutes ago. Okay. So it's very common in activist circles, Jewish Voices for Peace, you know, these types of groups on Twitter, et cetera, to lay the settler colonial narrative out that basically most Jews are white Europeans, and they can't claim, you know, indigenous rights, even if whatever, how many hundreds or thousands of years ago, maybe they had relatives that lived there, but even still since then, they were essentially brought to the region during the British Mandate, British colonialism, right? I'm gonna go back up to what this right wing, in my interpretation, you know, rabbi said, which was extremely false and racist. He said that Palestinians are just Arabs, right? They're not really Palestinians, which is interesting because it's closely aligned with this claim that basically Ashkenazi Jews aren't really Semites is what it's getting at. They're not from the area. And I'll get to that, why that's a huge claim to make and why it's extremely anti-Semitic. But before we get there, it's very similar to what this rabbi is saying about Palestinians not really being Palestinians, but being Arabs, right? He clarifies that Palestinians aren't even indigenous to Palestine, just like that tweet inferred, and many on the left say that people living in Israel today aren't indigenous to the region, right? The rabbi said that these Arabs migrated to the region from the surrounding area during the British Mandate. That's we inferred, and many on the left infer, that these white Europeans migrated to Israel during the British Mandate. And you know, I just think I'll get to the comments coming in because I'm sure that people have a lot to say. Without getting into, you know, who's right or wrong, I think that when there are parallels like this, you have to stop, and regardless of all the yeah buts, just say, you know, like, what are we doing here, right? How is any of this getting you closer to ceasefire or a peace resolution. And that is when you have to begin to think about the motivations of people and where they're coming from. There are people across the political spectrum who aren't interested in that for various reasons, and they all feel very secure and validated for believing so. It's a preview to things that might come way down the road, but what I'm kind of writing about too, right? So it kind of goes back to this discussion I had with this progressive rabbi about talking about suspicion, right? When we start seeing these things filtering through. So I want to stay on this topic. So, okay. It presents a narrative that many on the left echo, which is essentially most Jews in Israel are white Europeans that aren't indigenous to the region, but brought in during the British Mandate. Well, what does that sound like? Remember that thing that I asked you to remember. It sounds a lot like what the rabbi was saying. And I know people are going to say, well, he was wrong and I'm right. Okay, fine. Okay. I mean, that's your choice to think like that. But when I began thinking parallel to people for whom I extremely disagree with, I stop and I self-reflect on what it is. Where am I going? Right? Where am I going? And I open myself up to self-critique as well as outside critique too. Right? It's all constructive criticism. So staying with this, what's the problem with saying this? What's the problem with saying, just go back to Europe or Brooklyn? Well, I mean, aside from the insinuated violence it would take for that to occur, which is probably justified in an anti-colonial or decolonization type of framework. I'm thinking like Fanon, you know, something like that. There's another more statistical, you know, issue with this. So it's just not accurate. 45% of Israel's Jewish population had grandparents from North Africa or Asia. They're Sephardic Jews. About 32% had grandparents from Europe. But that also includes the Americas, Oceania, or South Africa. And those are the Ashkenazis, which is what 99% of people on Twitter or activist groups on all sides, left, right, et cetera, they're talking about most of the time Ashkenazi Jews, right? But that only makes up 32% of the total population of Israel. Around 12% had ancestors who came from the ex-USSR. You hear this sometimes, especially if we're talking about Zionism, and 3% from Ethiopia. And then there's a contingent, 8 to 10% of mixed backgrounds. And then there are even smaller, you know, sub-denominations of Jewish groups, along with other demographic groups that aren't represented in that analysis because they're not Jewish. So this is not a dichotomy, right? I guess when we're talking about the people that are currently living in Israel, and you know, it's important to note that this way of categorizing people isn't perfect either. So, for example, you could have a Bulgarian Jew who would be considered Ashkenazi by geographic definition, but who would probably, because of the proliferation of people from that region, identify as Sephardic. And you know, this type of nuance is just left out of these discussions, and it's very dehumanizing. And I'll get to the rebuttal, right? The rebuttal really is that I think for some people, this is a way of expressing their outrage over what's happening. And that's acceptable. You know, that's understandable. But expressing it in this way is also dehumanizing and is also not being in solidarity along any type of, if you're a Marxist, class lines. I don't want to get in. It's so complicated. I don't even want to get into it in that way, but you're essentially becoming the polar opposite of what we just read with this rabbi. And then at the end of the day, you have to say, well, what is your goal, right? What is it that you're trying to achieve? Is it a greater Israel? Is it a greater Palestine, right? Or is it a peace and ceasefire? And just saying go back to Brooklyn isn't really jiving with the last piece. But, you know, there's more, and it's not to pick on that one thing, but it's to also illuminate kind of a misunderstanding of what the country whose government you should be criticizing right now, Israel, but it's to really understand what it is you're criticizing, as opposed to demonizing this thing and making it into a slogan, because that doesn't go anywhere good either, right? So, more troubling, I've seen social media posts positing what amounts to the Khazar conspiracy, which is kind of what I alluded to much earlier. Jews aren't really Jews, right? A post by an acquaintance. It's someone that I know, like, personally. It's not someone I just met online. I know this person in real life, who I otherwise share much in common with. They shared this thing. It was from the Palestinian Finnish Human Rights Group, whatever that group is. And it states that the genetic studies show 97.5% of Judaics, whatever that means, living in Israel have no ancient Hebrew DNA, whatever that means, and are therefore not Semites. I have it. Here. So this is, I didn't grab the other tweet about go back to Brooklyn, but I mean, it's kind of straightforward, right? You know, this one's really interesting because it came, so there's a lot of levels to this. It's from a Palestinian group. I'm not showing who it shared from. I'm not doing that, but someone that I know, they're politically, you know, pretty much on the right side of things. John Hopkins study, genetic study showing 97.5% of Judaics living in Israel have absolutely no ancient Hebrew DNA and therefore not Semites and have no ancient blood ties to the land. Okay, now we're talking blood and soil, right? Whereas 80% of Palestinians carry ancient Hebrew DNA and thus are real Semites. All right. So this is problematic for obvious reasons that I don't think I even really need to explain, but I would like to also point out the idea of intent, because I know this person. In the past, their intent has been good. They're sharing this thing about genetics and blood and land. And, you know, my question is why? Why? What's the point? But how does that image get you closer to ceasefire or peace? I mean, it clearly doesn't. So then why are you posting it? Well, that's the troubling part, right? That's the part that I think we need to think about and reflect on. And it's not to pick on this one, you know, post either. I think there's a lot of this happening. And it's complicated, I understand, and I'll get to why it's complicated. But it is happening. And it's something that no one's going to touch with a 10-foot pole. And I don't know why. I guess it's because I don't know. I don't, maybe they're afraid to, I don't know. I'm not going to, you know, I have some ideas, but. All right. So what's the point in publishing something like this in the first place? It obviously is not true. As written, given the fact that most Jews in Israel did not come from Europe, or Brooklyn, for that matter, it conflates a few things, which I think underscore why it's problematic. It underscores, again, that misunderstanding of Ashkenazi Jews and the real power structure and the real criticisms you could have to Ashkenazi Jews, perhaps if we're critiquing the power structure and politics within Israel. But instead, as compared to maybe, you know, Sephardic Jews or Jews from Ethiopia or other things. But it conflates and misunderstands Ashkenazi Jews and that real power structure discussion around that group compared with Sephardics or other groups to or with modern settler colonialism in the region, like the Golan Heights that we just talked about, right? So these are like two different things that's kind of incorrectly merging. And then also the right of return policies for Israel, which were in the news just a few years ago. So it's another thing kind of working backwards. It's kind of conflating, go back to Brooklyn, the idea of right of return for Jewish people to Israel with what happened with the Golan Heights. And we just talked about how that was really accelerated under the Trump administration. And then going back to a misunderstanding of Ashkenazi Jews in relation to other Jews. And it's a lot of misunderstandings kind of rolled up into this little ball. And it's clearly rolling into a very dangerous place, right? So it brings to the kind of that we'll get to, I think, probably a modern settler colonial discussion in regions like the Golan Heights, right? And it goes to a decolonial critique, again, kind of in that Fanon tradition, which, or perhaps in a very, very, very flattened discussion of any type of dichotomy you can view. It could be proletariat and the bourgeois, for instance, if it's an extreme flattening and just leaving a lot of things out. But it's creating a false dichotomy, simplifying things, which kind of ultimately, at the end of the day, I can't see any utility in doing it except for justifying violence. And even you can have that discussion about the right to resist, but to a point, right? And there's nuance with that. With all of this, again, it still brings me back to the question of how is all of that getting you closer to ceasefire or peace? And it's a lot of misunderstandings going in a lot of different directions that would take a very long time to unpack in just one little thing, right? But it's not necessarily uncommon, you know, in activist circles, and dare I say, even with some groups, you know, on the supposed left. There are legitimate pieces of fact to pick from each of those for a broader discussion, but combined into this meme or screenshot, it ends up looking a lot like the Khazar myth, which I had mentioned earlier. And, you know, ironically, I talked about that on my podcast about conspiracies of the right, not the left, but the right, when discussing how racist serpent seed doctrine, for instance, mixed with British Israelite theories that helped create the Christian identity movement in the United States, which is a far right movement, which has produced multiple terrorists like Atlanta Olympic and abortion clinic bomber Eric Rudolph, ultimately to anti-Semitic, anti-communist rhetoric of the 1950s and kind of the beginning of the modern far right alliances we see today, whether you want to talk about the Tea Party or MAGA now. Like, I covered this theory in order to talk about the far right in the United States. And it's essentially encapsulated in this, you know, pro-Palestinian leftist thing. So, you know, I want to take a step back and say, it's clearly not representative of a lot of things, right? This was one thing that I've seen out of many, 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 many other things that have been very positive and good. But it exists, you know, and I'll get to discussions about, you know, the complications of talking about such things right now. But, you know, it can, for what it actually is, it probably goes back to a study by Aaron Elhaik, who argued that Ashkenazi populations may have had origins in Irano, Turco, Slavic, and Southern European descent. Which was immediately contested, not only for methodology, but also just for the interpretation of the data and a lack of understanding of how to interpret the data that he actually gathered in the first place, especially from Jewish populations. Again, it kind of just, but it, I still go, it doesn't matter. Like, this doesn't matter. It unless we're going full blood and soil, like, unless the left is now blood and soil, and we're just going to ignore statistical demographics of the region. Instead, perhaps being, I think this happens, we become influenced by our personal anecdotal experiences and misunderstandings, especially maybe people in the United States who might know Jewish people. But also, it's eliminationist. And it's eliminationist in an anti-colonial outfit. And not very different, again, from the BS that the rabbi said about Palestinians. All that this rhetoric helps in terms of real world and real world outcomes is Islamophobia and anti-Semitism spread online and potentially in activist circles. And it has nothing to do with any actual real life mechanisms to create a ceasefire or peace. Again, if that's the goal. And then we have to ask ourselves, well, is that the goal? And that discussion can go in a lot of different ways, can't it? And it will in the future. So, all right, kind of bringing it back. The discussion got a little, it got a little meta here. So it's relevant because it's tied to things that this rabbi has stated in relation to religious interpretations of Trump's actions, and it will keep happening. I spoke with someone off the record last week, and we were talking about a similar phenomenon, basically that we've seen some legitimately ugly stuff, not from white nationalists trying to rebrand themselves or sneak into protests, but stuff just from the left. And the conversation was guarded, and it seemed to arrive at the conclusion that essentially no one's talking about this stuff now because now is not the right time. There's a forced migration, at least, or ethnic cleansing at worst happening. And that should be the focus. You know, now is not the right time to be talking about these other things. And I understand that. That is happening. The concept of Greater Israel by a far right Israeli government is occurring right before our eyes, right? From the river to the sea, but it's not Palestine, it's Israel. That's what's going on. And we talked about that, right? October 7th allowed for this to occur for many different reasons. But, you know, I said, paraphrasing to this person, that maybe it's my still young, dumb mind, but, you know, I've heard this before, whether it's about women's rights or LGBTQ rights or racism. And, you know, I asked during those things, you know, if now is not the right time, when will the right time be? And that's a constant question that's always asked, right? Because now we're getting into weird Jimmy Dore territory, right? Why not just you know, cozy up to white nationalists and MAGA so that maybe we can get policy change? And yes, they all actively want you disenfranchised and maybe killed, but we'll get this policy change and we'll get back to you later. All right. So it's just this total BS, and I've heard it too many times, this promise that we'll circle back to you once the big thing, the important thing, is done. You're not, you know, insinuating whatever, you're not important, right? But, you know, until then, just suffer. Just suffer for now, and, you know, trust us. It's never the right time for some people, even on the left. And, you know, when we're doing this, it's, What is it that we're even doing if valid critique is shut out, right? If we're creating a situation in which leftists, progressives, anti-authoritarians, anarchists, socialists, what have you, can't honestly critique each other in good faith, then again, what is it that we're doing? It brings us back to the idea of, what's our goal? Is the goal ceasefire and peace or not, right? Is the goal to build coalition, to be better, to become better, or not? So, you know, there will be a lot more of that to come. It's just something that, you know, talking about adding around the timeline, because up till now, especially the first episode, this has been pretty historically based, and I have a background in history, so, you know, that happens. But now we're beginning to flesh out some of this stuff. And it's why I only focus on a few things during the Trump administration, right? Because all of these things existed, that all these discussions are now coming into play, right? And they exist around these current events, not necessarily history, right? But current events. And that's just not something people are talking about. And then, you know, I have, again, personal ideas for why. I'm not going to insinuate why and project on other people. Okay, so we'll do next time, and then I'll look at some of these comments. So next time, relations between some Arab countries and Israel normalized. This is going to be a huge event that we need to talk about, the idea of normalization with Israel and leaving the Palestinian question, issue, peace to the side in order to accomplish that. I'll talk about the 2021 Israel-Hamas crisis, and then the deadly year of leading up to 2023, the deadly year in Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I don't know if I want to get into Hamas. I might save that for another one. So the next one might be shorter than this. All right, let's look at these and look at some of these comments here. Yeah, they have been at some odd times. Yeah, talking about Christian white nationalists, not us, yeah. Parse through all the different disinformation and conspiracies. Yeah, you know, a lot of what I'm working on begins in that and then progresses out of that into more of the discussions that we just had. Talking about ETs. Yeah. And but you know, the thing is that it's not for this episode, but it is that, but there's a lot of ways to frame that. You can frame that in a decolonial perspective. You could frame that in a Marxist perspective. You could frame that in an Islamist perspective. You know, there's an Islamic nationalist perspective. So there's a lot of ways to do that. And you know, I'm confident we'll get there. But for now, yeah, right? Persian Jews, sure. Okay, so now we have some names being called out. all these people. You know, I've talked to people and I don't like doing that, but it is because it was off the record and I want to honor that. But yeah, you know, people like Syrian Girl, Max Blumenthal, Aaron Matei, there's not enough time to talk about them, but I spend a lot of time talking about them when I'm writing, and we'll get to them. And I've talked about them, you know, kind of colloquially, whether it's about the video on Left-Right Alliance or whether it's about Ukraine. But these are not pro-Palestinian voices, you know. But I think for now, what I'll say, though, is that while people might not take them, you know, straight up seriously, they still have a lot of power in terms of reach and a lot of power in terms of what they can boost and share and how things that maybe are less blatant than stuff like Syrian Girl post or, you know, Blumenthal post, how that can be spread and infiltrate into or act as entryism into left-wing circles for whatever reason. To divide or confuse or for ideological reasons, that discussion is a lot of what I'm currently focusing on in the writing. I'm at that point in the writing, and it's kind of funny because then I actually kind of go backwards and talk about the stuff that we've talked about, some of the historical stuff, and then getting into some of these critiques, going all the way from the right to third position to the far right. White nationalists to the left, and you know, looking at ways forward. Claire Daly, Mike Wallace, yep, Yeah, all the usual suspects, and you know, it's those are politicians, you know. Yeah, you know, Galloway just won an election on a pro-Palestinian platform. All right, I'm going to stop there because I want to keep these an hour, and we're an hour 30. So now we're beginning to flesh it out a little bit, and we're beginning to talk around the history. The first two I know have been pretty event and history based. So will the next episode, but from there we'll begin to get into some other ideas as well. And you know, hopefully after the next session we'll begin looking into Hamas. Some of that's going to have to do with my hardware. I'm using a different computer right now, and I can't really use it to access sites that you know aren't necessarily the best and brightest. So I'll need to find a replacement in order to get into some of those areas. But I already have quite a bit of that worked up. So, all right. Thanks for watching this. A month, 4 weeks, 5 weeks. That'll be the next one, and then we'll get to October 7th. All right, all. Thanks for hanging out.